Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 97 on Friday, May 28, 2010. Back in Denver this week, enjoying a stretch of mainly gorgeous mile-high weather here, while I have heard reports from Cambridge of some early dog days of summer, hot and humid, so I'm glad I missed that. I will return to Cambridge on Sunday, which means I will be preparing episode 98 back at sea level near the banks of the Charles River. My flight home on Sunday will probably take me over Chicago, which is home for this week's interview guest, J.A. Conrath. Joe has been in the news recently for a groundbreaking Amazon Encore contract for the seventh book in his Jack Daniels Police Detective series, due out in October as a Kindle book, to be followed in February of 2011 by the print edition. As I was editing the interview yesterday, Darlene was overhearing it, and at supper she said, "That guy was fun to listen to because he has so much energy and optimism." He also, I think, provides an up-close and personal look at how Amazon's smart forays into the publishing business are really changing the game and bringing pretty amazing opportunities to authors willing to work as hard as Joe and who have got good material to present to readers and are willing to fully take advantage of these new technological opportunities. In news, Jeff Bezos, Amazon's CEO and founder, made a few illuminating statements about Kindle's strategy at the Amazon.com annual meeting. Penguin Books are returning to the Kindle store. Barnes & Noble released an impressive iPad application with at least one glitch. And O'Reilly Media's one-day $10 ebook sale a week ago was so successful they had difficulty keeping up with the demand. I received some help with the tech tip this week from Jesslyn Hendricks, and it's about how to reset the sync feature that enables you to pick up where you the furthest read position in your Kindle book across the various devices and platforms. With that, let's turn to the news. Jeff Bezos, in his comments at the Amazon.com annual meeting yesterday, May 27th, was hitting the same notes of the comments by Jay Marine a couple of episodes ago in the podcast, using the same phrase, purpose built for reading, and that was picked up in a lot of the coverage. There is a link, which I'll have in the show notes, that has the audio for the entire annual meeting, and I've taken just a couple of clips from it of what Bezos had to say. It's sort of straight from the horse's mouth, and here's what he said at the end of his prepared remarks just before he took questions.
We launched Kindle less than 3 years ago. It's only about 30 months old. It's a device that's purpose-built for reading. You can read it in bright sunlight. 3G wireless is free, no annual contracts, no monthly fees, and it has a very large bookstore. The Kindle selection, even though we launched the store, less than 3 years ago, has already grown from 90,000 bestsellers at launch to over 540,000 bestsellers today. And that doesn't even count the 1.8 million free, out-of-copyright, pre-1923 books that are also available for Kindle. We've sold millions of Kindles, and we're very excited about the future of that business. It's a great job for a missionary product team, and missionaries build better products. We have made the Kindle books, so when you buy a Kindle book, you, of course, can read it on your Kindle, but you can also read it on any device that you'd like to read it on. We've so far released applications, Kindle apps, for the PC, for the Macintosh, for the iPhone, for the iPad, for the BlackBerry, and coming in just a few weeks is Kindle for Android. We're very excited about that. We want people to be able to read anytime, anywhere they want. The vision for Kindle is every book ever printed in any language, all available within 60 seconds. How cool would that be?
Another cool thing for the Kindle would be a color display, and in the question period, Jeff was asked for an update on when color might be available in the future. Here's what he had to say to that.
I have seen several different kinds of, especially, I'm talking about reflective displays like the Kindle. Obviously, if you want to have color with an LCD display, that's very, very easy. That's the most mature technology, and it is color. The LCD display comes with some significant drawbacks. For long format reading. Among them is increased eye strain because it's sort of like reading with somebody shining a flashlight in your eyes, which is fine for short form reading, but if you really want to lay back and read for 3 hours. It's not the most comfortable reading experience with these backlit LCD displays. The second problem with these LCD displays is that they are very power hungry because they have to be backlit. And so you get short battery life. So the only way that we can get sort of 2 week battery life that Kindle has is with that electronic paper reflective display. And then a final problem, of course, with LCD displays is that they just don't work in bright sunlight. So all of those, you know, all the beach book reading, vacation reading, and things like that become very complicated, basically impossible with an LCD display. So if you're talking about reflective displays, high quality color is still some ways out. I've seen things in the laboratory, and there are several things in the laboratory, but they're not quite ready for, primetime production.
One question which I didn't see widely reported in terms of Jeff's answer was about the recently concluded test of Kindle DXs in a number of universities. In this response, he gives two examples of things which they learned from the pilot project at the universities.
You can do annotation and note-taking on a Kindle, but if you need to do heavy annotation, it becomes more complicated. So those are the kinds of things. Other examples are that came out of the feedback from those pilot programs were for, it's very, because the font size, because font sizes can be changed on Kindle, the concept of a page number becomes more complex. But for academic purposes, you often have to be able to cite a page number. And people, we provide a citation method. It's called location numbers. But unfortunately, it's not, a universal standard. And so, another piece of feedback is that for academic purposes, you need some way of translating location numbers to physical book page numbers.
I'll close with this excerpt, which is a question and answer which made me smile because of the times I've received similar answers from other Amazon executives when I've tried to get a clue as to what might be coming. Here's how the founder and CEO handles that kind of a request.
I thought I saw in the past year that Amazon acquired a startup company that was working on touchscreen technology. And do you plan to incorporate any of that in the Kindle in the future?
It's a great question. Unfortunately, we have a longstanding practice of not discussing our future roadmap, mostly for competitive reasons. We like to surprise people with what we're doing. So I can't really give you a direct answer to your question.
Item 2 in news, Penguin's ebooks are returning to the Kindle store after the publisher reached agreement with Amazon on pricing. Penguin announced the agreement on May 26. Since April 1st, 150 of Penguin's new books have not been available for the Kindle. A Reuters story reported that David Shanks, chief executive of Penguin Group, said in a statement, "We have reached an agreement with Amazon, and we are pleased that a full selection of our books will be available on the Kindle. Terms of the agreement were not disclosed by either company." Item 3, Barnes & Noble on May 27th launched an ebook reader for the iPad, which does have some impressive features. With it, you can highlight and make notes on your ebooks the way you can with the Kindle for iPad app. But unlike the Kindle app, the B&N e-reader for iPad can also look up words in a dictionary or take you with one click to Safari searches in Google and Wikipedia the way you can with the Apple's iBooks app. On the horizontal dimension, when you hold your iPad horizontally, the B&N e-reader usually shows you only one page stretching across the wider screen the way the Kindle app does, and not the more pleasing two-page view of Apple's iBooks app. But one book I bought from Barnes & Noble did split the text into two columns on the horizontal view, so it apparently depends on the book as to what you're going to see when you flip your iPad to the horizontal. One mistake B&N made, in my opinion, is they did not include the ability to adjust the brightness of the screen within the app, as you can do in both the Kindle and the iBooks apps. This feature helps overcome the iPad's drawbacks in readability compared with the Kindle or the Nook, which both have an easy on the eyes e-ink screen. The other important failing the Barnes & Noble app has compared with the Kindle is you can't synchronize it across devices to the furthest page read. At first, I was also impressed to see that the BNN app can read newspapers and magazines on the iPad purchased from Barnes & Noble, and I was able to download a copy of the Washington Post, and it worked. Stephen Windwalker, however, later in the day ran into technical difficulty trying to open his copy of the Boston Globe that he'd purchased, and as we each tried other publications, more problems emerged, specifically with the New Yorker and the International Herald Tribune. When I called Barnes & Noble's customer support, they said they could not refund the money I'd spent. The person I talked to said they were aware of the problems and would be working hard to fix them. This morning, I was still unable to open the International Herald Tribune that I purchased yesterday, and when I purchased today's edition of the Wall Street Journal, I received the same very irritating message when I attempted to download it to the iPad, quote, "We are sorry, this item is not yet supported on this device." This morning I also received an email from listener Mary McManus, who had difficulty getting the BNN app up and running on her iPad. She writes, "I do want to like the BNN app, but think it's still very buggy. We'll see if it settles down in the future." Meanwhile, we are still waiting for Amazon to update its Kindle for iPad app so that it will add search and dictionary to the current app. At that point, it will be on a par with the Barnes & Noble app, except for the newspapers and magazines availability, which will eventually be fixed at BNN. But in the meantime, it's a non-trivial flaw in an otherwise good effort. In my enthusiasm for the newness of the BNN app and its solid list of features, and perhaps my frustration at how long it's taking Amazon to update their Kindle app, early yesterday morning I posted a tweet saying, "Barnes & Noble now has the best book app for iPad." I wish I had waited about 8 hours before making that assessment, which I have since deleted and tweeted a correction. I'd say at this point the Kindle app is at least as good, with some missing features but with offsetting advantages. When the updated Kindle app arrives on the iPad, whenever soon is, I'm confident Amazon will once again be able to claim the undisputed title of best ebook app for the iPad. Item 4, O'Reilly Media on Friday, May 21st, had a one-day ebook sale with ebooks selling for $10. Their highly esteemed tech books generally sell for at least twice that, so the volume generated by the sale appeared to tax O'Reilly's ability to fulfill the ebook orders. There were reports on Twitter of hang-ups in downloading the books purchased. This morning I received the following response from O'Reilly's Andrew Savickas, whom I had asked for details of the sale. He wrote, "Friday's promotion resulted in our single biggest day of e-commerce sales ever on O'Reilly.com, and our servers and systems struggled to keep up with well more than 10 times the usual sales activity. Our deal of the day promo has been a hit since we started, but the response to opening it up across all titles was much greater than we anticipated. We're now shoring up our systems to better handle the continued sales growth of digital products, as well as occasional promotions and sales of the magnitude we saw Friday." I want to thank Andrew for his quick response, and also to listener Bill C., who tweeted me from his CUWAC1 Twitter username to suggest a story about the sale. This week's interview on May 26th went on a little longer than usual, so I'm going to jump right into the conversation and let my guest introduce himself.
My name is J.A. Conrath, and I am a writer. I write a series about a Chicago cop named Jack Daniels. Jack is a woman, short for Jacqueline, in her 40s, divorced, personalized a train wreck, but she's really good at her job, and she chases some pretty scary people. The books are all thrillers. They're funny, laugh out loud, but also have some scares, so you'll be giggling, then locking the doors and windows, and they're all named after drinks. The exciting news is the latest in the series, book number 7, is called Shaken. It's going to be coming out this October through Amazon's Encore program, which is a new program that Amazon has just recently begun, and they are now publishers. They are now competing with the big boys, and they're going to release Shaken as an ebook in October, and then in February release it in print.
Now, is that the big distinction? Because this deal has really gotten a lot of coverage, and people are talking about it in fairly dramatic terms. One of your commenters on the blog said Conrath's deal is the first execution in the French Revolution of publishing. but there have been other authors like Stephen Covey who have made separate deals with Amazon. What's distinctive about your deal that's generating so much interest?
I I'm not quite sure on the Covey deal. I did hear something about that. I think he's dealing directly with Amazon. Amazon is going to actually be my publisher.
Hmm.
And this is kind of groundbreaking for a couple of reasons. The Amazon Encore program was created last year in 2009 in order to discover new talent and give them a wider audience. So what they were doing is they were taking people who had self-published and were selling on Amazon and had decent sales and had been getting decent reviews, and then they were giving them the big Amazon publicity push. They were going to republish them and send out emails to everybody and give them some press and market them like crazy and try to reach a wider audience. Well, they'd only been doing this with new, unheard-of authors, people who didn't have agents, who didn't have previous books that had been published by big New York houses.
I see.
And with me, I'm going to be – I've got a firm mid list. I've got 7 books in print. I've got 3 other print deals in the works, so I'm going to have many more books coming out through the regular channels. But in this case, I guess a known quantity. I'm a name. I'm a brand, and I'm the first brand that Amazon is getting behind.
And this could certainly open the door to other writers in your situation.
Absolutely. I think it can open up doors to all writers in pretty much all situations, but it's especially interesting for authors who have already established themselves. Something like, I am not quite sure on the actual statistics, but I know there are more books out of print than are currently in print. And I know that's a high margin. So we've got a lot of books that are out of print that are still under copyright by authors who would love to make money off of their backlists. And we've got a lot of authors who, for whatever reason, perhaps their sales have declined, perhaps the publishers weren't selling as many as they liked, have series characters who just were abandoned, and they've got fans, and yeah, those fans want the books.
Have you heard from authors in the wake of the news of the deal, saying, gee, tell me more about this, to where you're getting a feel for how much interest it's generating?
I'm getting a lot of interest, and a lot of authors are interested, and of course the publishing industry is interested as well, and they're watching this close. What Amazon has done is they've put themselves in a position where they can directly reach the customers. And if you look at the history of publishing, all publishers have done is vet manuscripts, find the ones that they think are good enough to sell, and then try their hardest to get them in front of the consumers. And they've done this by basically selling paper.
Mm-hmm.
It's all a paper game. They sell a lot of paper. Whoever sells the most paper makes the most money, which coincidentally is also paper. They print advertising paper to sell more paper, and it's about moving a lot of paper. And that worked since Gutenberg. That's what it's been about. The paper would move from a publisher to a distributor, a warehouse. From the warehouse, it would go to the bookseller, and from the bookseller, it would go to the customer. Well, Amazon now can directly link the writer with the customer, with the reader. And when they're doing it electronically, there's no paper at all. It's instantaneous. Yeah. And it's so much easier to get an ebook out there than it is to print. Printing, believe it or not, with all this technology, all the majors still print offset printing, which is big printing presses where a specialist actually has to hand design each page, putting in all of those letters backwards so they can actually press ink on it. And you think that's archaic, but no, that's still how it's done now. And that's an inexpensive process. It's expensive to ship. Only 1 out of 2 books sold is considered successful. That's called sell-through.
Mm-hmm.
So for every 100 books a publisher prints up, if they sell 50, they're happy with that. That's considered average, and that means the other 50 are destroyed, they're pulped, they're remaindered, they're returned for full credit. What kind of business model is that? That's terrible.
Your first venture into the digital text platform, it sounded like it was you weren't planning to remake your whole life as a writer. You were doing it in response to a request from a reader.
Yeah.
And now you're actually to the point where you're saying that once you fulfill your current obligations, you doubt that you would accept another new print contract. So this is an incredible change just in your personal publishing profile. Talk to me about that.
Well, I did not expect this to happen, Len. This is the last thing that I could have possibly predicted. Ever since I was first published, my first novel, Whiskey Sour, the first Jack Daniel's book, came out in 2004. And then around 2004, 2005, when I had a website, I realized people on the internet are looking for two things. They're looking for information and they're looking for entertainment. For the information folks, I set up a blog called A Newbie's Guide to Publishing, where I just blog all about the publishing industry. For the entertainment side, I wanted my site to be sticky, which means I want people to go there and stay there and keep coming back, rather than it just be an advertisement for my books. Nobody likes advertising. So I put up books that my agent tried to sell but couldn't, books that New York rejected. And I had a couple of novels up there for free that people could download as PDF files. And, you know, I moved a couple hundred a year. It was nothing spectacular. I figured they were a gateway drug. Mm-hmm. You know, people buy them for free or get them for free, and then maybe they move on to the print books where I'm actually making money. Well, this Kindle thing came along in 2009, and I had several fans say, we would love to read these free ebooks, but we have Kindles. The first version of Kindle did not read PDFs. What can you do? So I learned about the DTP program, the digital text platform that Amazon had, and I put my books, The List and Origin and Shot of Tequila and Disturb, all up on Amazon. And I priced them, you know, as impulse purchases, you know, coffee money, $1.99 each. Well, that was April 2009. As of we're in May, May 25th, 2010. I've sold 46,000 ebooks.
Wow.
So this is making me over $150 a day on books New York didn't want. When Amazon changes their policy about royalties, it's going from 35% to the author. It's going up to 70% to the author on July 1st. So assuming my sales are consistent come July, in July I'll make about $13,000.
Wow. So your income doubles just by that change in the royalty.
Yeah, more than doubles, yeah.
Yeah. I think there's a non-disclosure agreement on the Encore book that's coming out, Shaken. Can you say whether – I would assume that the royalty would be the same as the DTP, but is that one of the things you can't say?
Right. Okay. I really can't say anything about that. I can say that I'm selling very well on my own, and I still signed with Amazon. I'm thrilled to be working with Amazon, and they're so damn smart, Len. Uh-huh. I've been talking to publishers for years, and I think publishers and editors are pretty much smart across the board. These are people who love books. They love the business. They're not doing it for the money. They're doing it for the love. But these guys are completely savvy. I said, look, I'm selling like crazy at a low price point. I know you guys control Shaken, which is the book they bought, the 7 Jack Daniels book. You set the price, but I really recommend you set it low, around $3.
Yeah.
Well, they set it for $3.
Yeah.
Set it for $2.99. And then I also said, you know what? Everybody I know, me included, hates digital rights management. And for your listeners who don't know, digital rights management are all the restrictions that copyright owners and companies put on digital media to prevent you from doing things like copying the media, sharing the media, putting the media on more than one device. All these annoying things that really piss off consumers. And I said, you know, no one likes DRM. And just about every book on Amazon right now is DRM protected, all mm-hmm. of the ones by big publishers. Shaken will not be. Shaken is going to be released $2.99 without any digital rights management. And I'm thrilled.
Now, it will be still in the Kindle format, the .azw format, right?
Yes.
So the fact it doesn't have DRM, it means I could download it to my wife's computer and put it on her Kindle without being in the same Amazon account, but I wouldn't be able to read it like on a Nook or a Sony Reader because of the lack of DRM.
Well, we're working on trying to do something for that. I don't know if I can't predict what exactly is going to happen. I know there are converters. I don't know what the legality of these converters are, but I know they are available. And if you're able to download,
yeah, that's right. You could probably use something like Calibre.
Sure.
If it doesn't have the DRM, then you could just switch it to an EPUB using the converter. Yeah,
right.
So that's really
significant. You could also use Stanza. Yeah, Stanza is another one that'll convert to many different file formats. So you should be able to.
Yeah, so that's really significant because it does enable you to buy the book and then, you know, in some cases with a little horsing around with the technology, read it anywhere you want it.
Sure, and then keep it. Yeah. So when Kindle 17 comes out and the format changes, you don't have to buy the book again. You can put it on your Kindle 17 in the year, 2025, and it should be able to the content will be savable. You won't have to repurchase the same book like we've done with beta to VHS to Laserdisc to DVD to HD DVD to Blu-ray.
Are you breaking ground there? Are you aware of other serious publishers on the Amazon platform that are putting their books out without DRM?
I believe this is a first for Amazon, and I'm not aware of anybody else doing it yet. I'm fully prepared to be a guinea pig for Amazon. I mean, they're doing great by me. I'm thrilled to be working with them. And if they want to experiment with my book, I'm more than happy to let them experiment and try new and different things and try and truly figure out what is it the customer is looking for. What's the best experience we can give the reader with this book?
It's sort of reverse windowing, at least the way the term has been used by irritated ebook readers when they have to wait a couple of months. So what's the thinking behind having the print version come several months after the ebook version?
It's so much easier to set up and release an ebook version than it is a print version. Print, of course, involves being printed. It involves contacting bookstores and sending out galleys and trying to get pre-orders and having the sales team go out and try to set up accounts with libraries and big box stores and all these different outlets that are going to sell the book. The printing, the shipping, the warehousing, all of that takes time. It's just much easier to release the digital version first, and I'm thrilled that that's happening because that means Kindle readers, and when the holiday season hits in 2010, all the people who have new e-readers are going to be able to get this instantly rather than have to wait, which it's unfortunate that the print is going to be delayed, but that's just how the publishing business always works. In fact, I think the last five of my books that came out, I turned them in 18 months before they were actually published. So normally it's a year and a half wait. Actually, Amazon is doing better for the print version than just about any publisher I've had.
That's amazing. Now, and I pre-ordered Shaken. You can go to Amazon right now. I see you've also got a sample of it. What's the thinking on that?
Well, I believe Amazon wanted to capitalize on the early interest and all the buzz that this deal has been getting, and they asked me, can we put up a couple of sample chapters for free, of course? And I said, absolutely. You know, that's a no-brainer. Everybody should do that with ebooks. It's like a coming attraction that gets people into the theaters. You know, the coming attraction comes out a couple months earlier.
Yeah, it creates quite an appetite. It leaves you hanging, and then I put on my calendar the date in October when I'll be able to read the rest of the story. So
great. Thank you.
Now, one thing that in your blog, the Publishing for Newbies blog, you have been sharing actual data from your experience selling ebooks on the Kindle.
Sure. Yeah.
Has that been okay in terms of agreements that you have to sign with Amazon? You've been in any kind of a gray area just by being that forthcoming, or were
oh,
you just
not at all?
Okay,
not at all.
What are the rules there? Anybody can do that. It's just most people have chosen not to.
Right. It's like asking what your salary is. You know, it's but people don't ask, don't tell. Everybody, you know, wants to hide money and hide numbers, and you know, publishing is based on a lot of buzz and a lot of hype, and telling exact numbers isn't always necessarily the best thing. I've kind of approached this at a different angle. I believe that numbers should be known. And while you can never compare yourself to any other author and never compare yourself what advances you're getting, how much money you're making, what your sales are, I think it's important for people to know that this is now a viable opportunity for authors to directly reach readers. I mean, this is the biggest innovation since Gutenberg invented the press.
Mm-hmm.
We've got now no barrier. We don't have vetters. We don't have gatekeepers. We don't have anybody saying you're the anointed one and you go back to the drawing board. We don't think you're going to sell. Now the vetters are the readers.
Yeah.
Now I'm fully behind people attempting or more than attempting. I'm behind people self-publishing. Using the DTP program with Amazon, it's free.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty easy. If you need help with it, then there are people who can help you. I use a guy named Rob Siders at 52novels.com. He does a lot of my formatting for me because it can get kind of tricky. Mm-hmm. I use a friend of mine named Carl Graves to give me really decent professional-looking book covers. But other than that, you can do this on your own. Just make sure the book you're putting up there is a good book.
Right.
Because you don't have to please agents and editors anymore if you're self-publishing, but you still do have to please a very important group, and those are the readers. And if you're putting up crap, they're not going to buy it, and they're going to tell others not to buy it, and you're just spinning your wheels.
Yeah. Yeah, so it really starts at the quality of the work itself, which is the place it's always started.
Absolutely.
Hmm. Now, you had a lively exchange based on the Publisher's Weekly story. And there was a follow-up that reporter Rachel Deal. Did you actually get a chance to talk to her at the Book Expo? Or?
No, she did not come out and introduce herself to me for, I'm guessing, obvious reasons.
Well, was she covering the panel that you were on?
I was on a panel in New York at the Do-It-Yourself Expo at the beginning of Book Expo America. It was a full house. Uh-huh. We had quite a few people in the crowd, and I didn't notice anybody in particular there. So she may have been in there. She may have had a tape recorder in there. I'm not sure, but it was a flattering piece she did.
She called you the it boy of self-publishing. Maybe that's her way of an apology for the factual errors that she had.
I don't think reporters apologize.
I'm sure she felt the heat, though. I loved reading that thread of comments after you know, it was basically some factual things she just got wrong about when the book was being published and stuff like that. But
more than that, she got numbers wrong. She got dates wrong. And, you know, you could say, okay, kind of sloppy mistakes, not very good journalism. But when you get that much wrong and then you draw a conclusion from incorrect facts, well, then that slants the article. And then that's just not – that's really, really not good for anybody. It didn't make Publishers Weekly look good. On the onset, it didn't make me look good, but I published the correct numbers. And as a result, I think I came out of this looking fine. One of the things the Publishers Weekly article alluded to was I settled with Amazon Encore.
Hmm.
I could not sell the series to any of the other big publishers, so Amazon Encore was my last choice. That's not how it works. And it also insinuated that was because of declining sales in the series. There were no declining sales for the first four books in the series, and after the fourth book, my publisher dropped their entire mystery line.
That was Hyperion?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I was included in that. That was just a unilateral decision. My books are in multiple printings. I have earned more than $200,000 on these six books. It was two three-book deals. The first three-book deal earned out. The second one is on track to earning out. The Publishers Weekly article compared my first book's paperback sales to my latest book's hardcover sales. And it said, well, look how far it's dropped. Well, guess what? Paperback, mass market paperback sells a hell of a lot more than the hardcover sales.
It's the old apples versus hardcover problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And then my publisher did not drop me because of declining sales. And when my agent shopped around a seventh Jack Daniels book, they did that 2 years ago.
Hmm. Before there was an Encore program.
Exactly. There was no Encore program yet. And they only sent it to five or I think maybe six tops publishers. We didn't saturate the market with it. By that point, I had three other publishing contracts.
Yeah.
I love Jack Daniels and I love writing those books, but I went on to other things and put her on hold.
Mm-hmm.
Then in 2010, Amazon Encore approached me because, as we mentioned earlier, they look for ebooks that are doing well and decide to give them a bigger push.
Yeah.
They approached me with one of my other properties.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to them, you know, how about we do something new? How about we do something original? How about we do the seventh Jack Daniels books, which had had on ice for about 2 years?
Mm-hmm.
And they were very happy with that idea. And it took a couple months to hammer out the contract with my agent, who did a terrific job vetting it and getting me terrific terms on this deal.
Mm.
And if Amazon Encore had been around 2 years ago, they would have been my first choice.
Sure.
It's not like, oh boy, they got the leftovers that New York didn't want.
Yeah.
No, I would have picked them right away. I love what they're doing. I love their attitude. I love how they're innovating. I love how they're jumping into this future with both feet. And I cannot really tell you how juiced I am to be a part of their group right now. It took me 12 years to finally land a publishing deal. I had more than 500 rejections. I wrote 9 books that did not sell. Over 1 million words I wrote, and I didn't earn a dime on them. And when I landed that first book deal with Hyperion for the Jack Daniel's series, I was determined to work my butt off and learn all I could about the industry in order to survive. And my books never got major co-op, which means they never got discounted at the front of bookstore chains for 40% off, right, or 30% off. Mm-hmm. My books were never in all of the big box stores like Walmart and Sam's Club. And the paperbacks were never in Walgreens or CVS or Duane Reade or Piggly Wiggly or any of those places. I've had all of my sales through traditional bookstores, and they've done well. Mm-hmm. They're in multiple printings. They're all still in print. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my peers who were published back in 2004, unfortunately, their books aren't in print anymore. Mm-hmm. I worked my butt off to sell these things. I sent out 7,000 letters to libraries.
Wow.
That was a couple garbage bags full of envelopes that we had to haul to the post office. 1 year, I visited 618 bookstores.
My God.
On tour. I was on the road for 38 days, 39 days. We called it the J.A. Conrath No Sex Tour. My wife almost divorced me for it. But that was going from bookstore to bookstore in 29 states, signing stock, meeting booksellers. Yeah. I mean, I've really worked hard to try and keep this career going. And A Newbie's Guide to Publishing documented, and it still documents, everything I've tried, what worked, what didn't work, what I'm learning, what's happening in the industry. And now that evolved into ebooks, and now, son of a gun, I'm making a pretty good living on the books New York rejected. And people are responding to that. But I have no desire to overthrow the status quo or New York publishing. New York publishing has been great to me, and they're great people, and I love them. And, I love print. I certainly don't want to see it go away. But, boy, they're making some bad decisions lately, and they're not seeing what I'm seeing. And they're not following the trends, and they're not listening to their customers. And guess what? Customers want inexpensive, downloadable content. The way to fight piracy is with cost and convenience. And ebooks without DRM at a low price are a perfect, perfect way to reach this customer.
If you'd like to reach more about J.A. Conrath, the easiest way to do it is simply to Google J.A. Conrath, and that's K-O-N-R-A-T-H. You will see Joe's Mystery Writer website as well as his Newbie's Guide to Publishing. Be sure to try his free sample of Shaken, which is available at the Amazon Kindle store. And if you like it, I hope you'll pre-order the Kindle version for $2.99, available in October, as did I. It's a good read, it looks like, and it's fun to sort of promote the significance of what's happening here. If you'd like to hear more reactions to Joe's Amazon Encore deal, I'm sure you will be interested in the Digital Book World's Roundtable podcast episode for May 19th. I'll have a link in the show notes. The audio quality sometimes is a little rough on these podcasts, but it's a really knowledgeable panel. And the entire conversation on this episode, hosted by Guy LeCharles Gonzalez, focused on whether the Shaken deal represents a game changer, a game nudger, a harbinger, or something else. And there was quite some diversity of opinion expressed by the panelists. The Digital Book World show notes page also has lots of links to other coverage of the deal and its implications. It really was a treat to have Joe on the show, and I will be following his adventures with interest on Twitter, where his username is J.A. Conrath, and elsewhere. In content this week, I'm not going to be able to give you the specific steps on how I did this, but I want to let you know that by poking around with Google in the Kindle-related forums, I finally managed to figure out how to borrow ebooks in MOBI format, that's M-O-B as in Boston, I, from my local libraries. And in my case, I've got a local library here in Denver and the Boston Public Library in Boston, where I was able to get an e-card. And I was able to download or borrow books from each of these libraries to read on my Kindle. There's a fairly simple way to do this, getting from Mobi to Kindle using a Macintosh, and I've seen that there's another method for PC users. The selection is not wildly extensive in the two libraries, but it's a pretty cool to be able to use the OverDrive ebook system on my Kindle. It's much easier on the Nook and the Sony readers and the Kobo, which are all set up with EPUB and Adobe's digital editions. But it is possible with some horsing around and some Googling, you'll be able to find your way to do this if it's something that interests you. And if you've got questions, feel free to send me an email at podchronicles@gmail.com, and I'll share more with you about my experience. Time now for your comments. Craig Scarberry emailed from Springfield, Ohio, saying that he enjoyed the interview with Mike Elgin. He added, "My experience with the iPad and the Kindle mirrors Mike's exactly, so it was interesting for me to hear him articulate my own thoughts and experience so well. I agree with you that the social media additions to the new Kindle software are interesting and useful. I don't have the new software yet, but I have been known to tweet interesting passages from books I'm reading. Do you think this is a potential breach of proper Twitter decorum? I hope not. I do it at least once per week." Parenthetically, I'd say absolutely not. I think that's a great idea for tweets. Craig continues, "I suppose it's likely that people don't care, but when compared to the overwhelming banality of the content that meets other people's standards, I'm not that concerned about it." Kip Poe Spiker emailed, "Another great show. Wanted to thank you for last week's reading material suggestion. Just finished William Styron's Darkness Visible, and yes, I had a lot of highlights for that book and found some other great authors to check out. The Kindle update that I'm still waiting to get sounds great, and yes, I will be using the Facebook and Twitter feed a lot. A couple of weeks ago, I started a blog," Kip continues, "my first one, and asked some authors I've talked to on the social networks if they would like to be interviewed for my blog, just to give them exposure and give a look into how they create. Then I posted on Kindle boards looking for authors to interview, and the project has skyrocketed. My blog gets lots of hits, and I get interview replies every day. In just about a week, I have over 50 interviews posted and having a great time with it." You can check out Kip's blog, which I've had a look at. It's a good interviews with authors about the writing process and how they write and intriguing things like that. It's at kippoe.blogspot.com. Alan Day emailed, "In response to your latest podcast, just a quick note to say that I am with you when it comes to social sharing of annotations from the Kindle. It's a feature I love, and I do it a few times a week. It's something I'd sort of always wanted, but never really even mentioned as something I wanted because I didn't figure it would become a reality. In the past, there were things I wanted to remember to share once I'd synced back to my PC or the Amazon.Kindle.com interface, but never did get around to it. Now, that's a thing of the past. From philosophy to fiction, no book gets read without a handful of annotations and usually a couple I'd like to share. The only thing about this feature I wish they'd done differently is the way non-Amazon books are handled. They are credited on the web simply as from a personal document. All title, author, metadata is ignored. I understand that they cannot link directly to a marketplace book from a personal document, but it would really go a long way if they'd at least include the title and, as applicable, author of the personal document. I do prefer the current configuration to having the functionality altogether disabled, which is what I feared would be the case, but it does make me a bit hesitant to share highlights, comments from things I'm reading that aren't from the Amazon marketplace." I wasn't aware of that distinction about the non-Amazon items and how they're handled, but that's interesting information from Alan. Thanks very much. Bob Anderson from Morgantown, West Virginia, sent a great, fairly lengthy comment about a two-week vacation that he had in Turkey and then on to Italy. And he had quite an adventure with the Kindle because he made the mistake of not setting the power converter. And at first he thought he'd fried the Kindle. This was in Turkey, and turned out it wasn't fried, and he was able to get it charged up at a hotel. So I'll read a little bit here where he picks up into after he got it charged. "The saving grace for me was that I had my iPod Touch with me. I could read books on it, which I would do early in the morning or late at night and not use the Kindle. On my Kindle, I could turn on the 3G for some weather forecasts, flight status, etc., and then turn it off, all, of course, at no charge. And one afternoon, upon entering a park in Istanbul, I saw a free Wi-Fi sign. In the course of a few minutes, I got a few books downloaded onto my iPod, along with the two podcasts you made while I was away." So it's great to hear the Kindle Chronicles being downloaded in Istanbul. So the Kindle came in handy in a number of ways, he writes. Some other interesting comments that Bob Anderson made here. He still has 2.3 on his Kindle, and he noticed in two books that he'd finished the underlined passages, which show what other people have considered to be that they've highlighted. And he's not really seeing that he doesn't really get the point on how that feature will become something I put a lot of value on. And he's also not really excited about the Twitter and Facebook options. He writes, I don't expect to use them. I guess what does excite me is that Amazon's adding those features seems to suggest that they plan to continue the experimental capability to enable the Kindle to web browse, etc. And maybe at some point they will change experimental to a better term. Speaking of web browsing, the first app I would love to see is being able to access my Mac Mail account on my Kindle, which would be great when I'm not at home or in the office. Bob also he's the one that suggested the interview with J.A. Conrath, and he provided some links to some of the interviews that he'd done. So that was a great suggestion, and as you can tell, I followed it. And finally, Jim Jones writes from Omaha, thank you for the interview with Mike Elgin in TKC 96. I've always enjoyed his technically knowledgeable and yet down-to-earth and even-handed commentary. I particularly had to Riley smile when he was opining on the wisdom of devices playing to their strengths rather than jumping on the Me Too bandwagon and losing their identity. It reminded me of the difficulties many businesses get into by practicing, quote, fad management, whether it be process engineering, quality circles, TQM, 360-degree performance appraisal, et al. Of recent vintage, all the way back to the Japanese management craze of the 1980s. All were our good managerial models in theory, but applied in a one-size-fits-all manner out of context, often they do more harm than good. It seems Mr. Elgin believes that the portable device industry may suffer from the same flawed thinking, but let's hope not. Finally, on your consideration of bringing a sponsor on board, I can appreciate your dilemma. I'm sure sponsorship would be very valuable in defraying production costs of the podcast and providing wider exposure for them, but it does always bring an implicit risk to independence. My greatest enjoyment as a listener comes from the intelligent conversations your interviews provide, without regard to supporting a particular party line or becoming an echo chamber. So I hope whatever you decide will allow you to maintain that characteristic. Good luck and take care. Thanks, Jim. Yeah, there's pros and cons to that sponsorship idea, so I'll be certainly not rushing into that. And I've seen some podcasts have opportunities to make donations that they put on the website. People help out. Leo Laporte does that and some others. So something like that might help out without having any impact on the independence that Jim talks about there. Thanks to everyone for your comments. If you've heard something that you'd like to weigh in on, please send me an email at podchronicles@gmail.com, or you can leave a comment at the show notes page at thekindlechronicles.com. Some of you who are longtime listeners may have noticed that there isn't any more audio comments line. With the one I was using, you had to call in every 30 days to keep it active, and I missed one of my call-in dates, so it evaporated. I think I may set up something with Google Voice at some point, but for now, if you have a comment, just please send me an email or leave a comment on the show notes page. If you haven't already, I hope you'll check out the Reading Edge page that I've got set up at Facebook. Just go to Facebook and search for the Reading Edge. I talk about details of the podcast and people there sharing links and questions. Pretty lively community that's grown up there around both this podcast and thereadingedge.com, which is my other podcast about ebooks in general. And there I uploaded a video review of the Kobo, which you can check out if you haven't seen yet. That'll be the e-reader arriving in Borders bookstores on June 6th. We're also making progress with ebooks for troops. Ken Clark has been working on our incorporation in the state of Connecticut. He's hard at work filing the 501c3 application, which will enable us to accept tax-deductible contributions. We had a glitch in sending our first two Kindles to Andre Corbin in Afghanistan. There was a transposition of one of the postal codes, and I don't know if they got all the way to Afghanistan or in some interim route, but when the package finally caught up with me, having been forwarded at the end from Denver to Cambridge, it had stamps all over it, and some of it looked like they were security or whatever. But I reboxed it, and we have the right code on it, and so it is now making its second attempt to get from Denver to Afghanistan, and can't wait to see how that works for the two soldiers, which will be receiving the Kindles as part of eBooks for Troops. And if you'd like more information about that project, just go to eBooksForTroops.org. Music for my podcast is Ramonk by Evel Monagat on the Variations in Time, a Jazz Perspective CD by Public Transit Recording, courtesy of IODA PromoNet. This is Len Edgerly from downtown Denver for the Kindle Chronicles. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast. Have a great day. Bye.